From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, the US makes a massive shift in policy in a bid to battle Ebola. Thousands of American troops and millions of American dollars will now head to West Africa.
There's really no substitute for having the massive surge of health workers. Some decisions have to be taken very quickly.
Also today, the latest from Scotland ahead of Thursday's referendum on independence. FSN's team is on the ground in Edinburgh and in London, where British comedian Eddie Izzard is campaigning to keep the country united.
I think it is a beautiful thing that Scottish people and English people, Welsh people, Northern Irish people, that we are together. We are the United Kingdom. We're a success. And to split that up is going to be tragic.
That's all ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. troops could be deployed in ground attacks against Islamic State militants. That's the message from Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, and U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, testifying earlier on Capitol Hill. U.S. military advisors are already on the ground, helping the Iraqi government in the fight against ISIS, but this was the first time U.S. military chiefs have suggested there could be boots on the ground deployed on combat missions. Washington correspondent Nina Maria Potts reports.
Testifying on Capitol Hill, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, said at some point he would recommend to President Obama that American military personnel would accompany Iraqi troops into battle against Islamic State militants. There are some 1,600 U.S. troops on the ground already in Iraq, but President Obama insists they're only authorized to defend themselves and have not engaged in combat.
The United Nations is calling for $1 billion to fight the spread of the Ebola virus. The appeal amount is a tenfold increase in the figure asked for just 1 month ago. Nick Harper reports from the UN in New York.
The UN's World Health Organization has described the worsening Ebola crisis as unparalleled in modern times. Announcing the $1 billion figure, the UN Ebola coordinator, David Nabarro, said the outbreak is advancing at such a speed as to make the dramatic increase in funds necessary. It's a tenfold increase on the $100 million amount the UN estimated it would need 4 weeks ago. The WHO now puts the death toll at almost 2,500 people, half of the almost 5,000 infected by the virus.
The UN's call for fiscal aid comes as U.S. President Barack Obama is set to announce that the American military will take the lead in dealing with the worst Ebola outbreak in history. Operation United Assistance will see up to 3,000 military personnel sent to the region in an effort that could cost up to $750 million. The Ukrainian government, under President Petro Poroshenko, has adopted a new law to allow self-rule for rebel-controlled areas of eastern Ukraine. Kiev has also granted an amnesty to pro-Russian fighters under the ceasefire agreement made on September the 5th. Jack Parak has more from Moscow.
The ceasefire agreement between Ukraine and Russia means separatists captured by the Ukrainian government forces should now be released. The rebels should then leave the government buildings they're occupying, release their prisoners and surrender their weapons. However, many of the rebels say allowing self-rule, but under the new Ukrainian government, is unacceptable and are calling for full independence to form a country called Novorossiya. It all comes amid reports of heavy and persistent shelling in the eastern Ukrainian regions of Luhansk and Donetsk, raising even more questions about the shaky ceasefire.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. British Prime Minister David Cameron has ruled out the creation of an English Parliament in the wake of Scotland's independence vote on Thursday. With London politicians promising Scotland more powers if it stays part of the UK, there are growing calls for a separate governing body for England. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
David Cameron says he will look at separate powers for England, but that for now he's concentrating on campaigning to keep Scotland in the United Kingdom. He insists, however, that we are not remotely near moves towards a distinct English Parliament. Prime Minister acknowledges a problem to be addressed is the anomaly that allows Scottish MPs to vote on English issues at Westminster, but not the other way around. And senior Conservatives say if Scotland's Parliament is to receive extra powers over tax and spending, then England should too. via its own parliament.
And the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development is drafting a battle plan to clamp down on Google-style tax dodging. Many technology firms are moving their profile to tax havens such as Bermuda or Grand Cayman to avoid paying more than $100 billion a year in the U.S. and Europe. Here's Rebecca Bowering from San Francisco.
The Paris-based research institute, the OECD, has been scrutinizing the tax avoidance tactics of companies like Google, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, and Starbucks. It recommends governments take action by imposing a country-by-country reporting regime on multinationals to make it harder for them to shift profits offshore. And it suggests giving valuable patent rights to shell companies based in tax havens. The proposals will be presented to G20 finance ministers in Australia later this week. All OECD members and 10 other countries, including China and Russia, have approved the plans. It's estimated that corporate tax inversion costs the U.S. alone at least $100 billion a year.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. As the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, conceded today that he may eventually have to recommend the use of U.S. ground troops in Iraq, 3,000 U.S. troops are to be deployed in Liberia as President Obama responds to the Ebola crisis in West Africa. The news was being announced in Atlanta today, where the president was visiting the headquarters of the Centers for Disease Control. The new American plan is being unveiled just 10 days after the Obama administration was widely criticized for only announcing the construction of a 22-bed hospital in Liberia, a country that is preparing to deal with thousands of new Ebola cases. It took a personal letter to the president from Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the Liberian president, to uncork the new American effort. It includes the supply of 400,000 treatment kits, the construction of 17 treatment centres, with the provision for 1,700 new treatment beds. Later in the programme, we'll hear from the scientist who first identified Ebola about the threat of the disease. But first, on the day the United Nations called for $1 billion in funding to battle Ebola, an interview with Karen Landgren, the head of the UN mission in Liberia. She spoke to Derek Mbata of UN Radio.
We're almost 6 months into the experience of Ebola, and the numbers are growing exponentially. The numbers that we know are very high, with over 1,200 deaths suspected or probable. But the World Health Organization has warned us that these aren't the real numbers.
What is being done to tackle this outbreak?
The health experts agree on what needs to be done. But what needs to be done is difficult to do in the context of Liberia. Liberia had a weak health facility, a weak public health capacity, even before this crisis, and Ebola has caused it to collapse. So the measures that need to be taken are that people need to protect themselves against disease transmission. In Liberia, this means taking care in caring for the sick. This has been a big route of transmission until now, and also taking care in traditional funeral rites, which involve often touching, washing the body, and have been the source of many, many new infections. Those who are sick have to have places to go to be cared for, holding centers, isolation centers, case management facilities of some sort. But because Ebola carries such risks, those who manage facilities have to be meticulous in their practices, in their decontamination, and so on.
Does Liberia have the resources to be able to tackle this challenge, given what you have just told me?
Liberia has been very open in saying it can't do this alone. The government is very stretched. They need to come back to the international community setting out their needs, but we're already hearing that maybe salaries of government staff won't be able to be paid in the coming months. The economy was scheduled to grow at 5.9%. That's been reduced downward to 2.9%. The finance minister has talked about a budget gap of approximately $116 million. There'll be a severe revenue shortfall because some of the main producers have slowed down their activities. Some staff are being laid off. So a big part of this is retaining the confidence of the investors in the country, that the country will weather this crisis of Ebola. But to do that, a lot needs to happen quickly. There's really no substitute for having the massive surge of health workers. They need to be equipped. There need to be adequate logistics. Some decisions have to be taken very quickly to let this happen.
That's Karen Landgren, the head of the UN mission in Liberia, talking there to UN Radio. And at the end of the programme today, an interview with Peter Piot, the scientist who first identified the Ebola virus. This is FSN Reports. There's now little more than 24 hours to go until the voting booths open in Scotland for the territory's historic referendum on independence. Both sides are pushing hard with last-minute campaigning, and the polls suggest the outcome will be close. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron and the leaders of the Liberal Democratic Party and the Labour Party have joined forces and published a pledge to devolve more powers to Scotland if Scotland reject independence on Thursday. However, the plan is being rubbished by the Yes campaign, and our coverage today begins with this report from FSN's Dan Whitehead in Edinburgh.
At the Caffeine Drip Cafe in central Edinburgh, owner and chef Christopher Wedge is preparing for lunch service.
This is the sausage we use, the pork and beef with coriander and different spices. And a homemade relish we do.
Christopher has lived in Scotland for 13 years. He came from Cape Town in South Africa to set up business. He's one of the around 7% of people who are yet to make their mind up on which way to vote on Thursday. As a business owner, he's worried about his taxes going up.
The importing costs are obviously very high at the moment, and we do import a lot of African products, and we try to educate the local Scots about our foods and stuff, and we do use lots of Scottish foods also, and we do a combination of both foods. So I think if the government could maybe less on taxation on imports and stuff, and we can educate the people in the UK or Scotland about our food.
More than 4 million people are registered to vote on the simple question, should Scotland be an independent country? Whether they vote yes or no, what's clear is that the Scottish people are passionate. The latest polls from those who've made up their mind show 49% for the Yes campaign and 51% for those who want to stay part of the UK. People's opinions are fiercely divided.
I'm very proud to be Scottish. I feel incredibly Scottish, but I really think it's very important that we remain part of the United Kingdom.
Why is that?
Well, look what happened when the RBS went bankrupt several years back now. It was the Bank of England that bailed us out. And I know that they're saying, oh, we can still use sterling and everything else. But we're going to be, if we go independent and we're going to be using sterling, it's going to come at a high price.
Well, after 15 years of devolution, I feel that it's, for me personally, it's time to stand on our own 2 feet and to make our own way in the world.
Why is that?
Well, personally speaking, I feel like an adult child still living at home with mum and dad. The time is right. To me, it seems the very obvious thing to do.
The Scots, of course, have a rich heritage and history. But Nicola McEwen from Edinburgh University says Scottish identity is not playing a part in this vote. Instead, it's the big issues.
It doesn't seem to be a huge factor. Neither campaign has really pushed an identity issue. Identity is not predominant for either side. And it doesn't seem to be driven by deep feelings of Scottish distinctiveness. Much more about pragmatic concerns about what it would mean for me and my family, what it would mean for the economy, what it would mean for the society. And so there is an important social dimension, and it's about public services, it's about the welfare state, it's about, and this is pushed very strongly by the Yes side, it's about whether or not independence could make for a better society.
In the final hours of campaigning, both sides are pushing hard. The UK Prime Minister David Cameron and the Liberal Democrat and Labour leaders have joined forces to pledge more powers for Scotland if they turn down independence. All three are on the front page of a major tabloid in Scotland. The three-point plan includes extensive new powers to the Scottish Parliament, a pledge that the UK exists to promote prosperity across all countries, and thirdly, more control for Scotland over its National Health Service funding. But the First Minister of Scotland and SNP leader Alex Salmond has described these last-minute promises as an insult to voters. He insists the only way Scottish people can guarantee more power and real change is to vote yes. The results will be out on Friday morning, but even at this late stage, it remains too close to call. Dan Whitehead, Edinburgh.
We stole countries with the cunning use of flags. Yeah. You just sail around the world and stick a flag in. I claim India for Britain. And they go, you can't claim us, we live here. 500 million of us. Do you have a flag?
The British comedian Eddie Izzard there in one of his best-known bits about the growth of the British Empire. But today, he's battling to prevent its shrinkage. Along with a host of other cultural figures, Eddie Izzard is backing the Better Together campaign, urging Scots not to embrace independence. He explained his view to Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio.
Yeah, we know it's totally their democratic right to do this, and it's great that it's democracy. That is a beautiful thing that we have centuries before 300 years of being together. We've had centuries of fighting and stuff, and people do forget that down the line. But this is a beautiful thing that democracy is happening. They do have that choice. It is not our choice, but I think it's very difficult for the people of Scotland to know what the people who are living in England, Wales and Northern Ireland think. Now, this is London, this is only just one city, but we could do this, we thought we would do this, and we just want to say, to ask them to please stay, because we'd like to say we would. I think it would be very sad, and it would be like a divorce of a family if they do go away.
Because I think it's only now that people, certainly in England, are thinking about the consequences of what could happen after a yes vote. And I guess we want to get away with the sort of the threats that keep being issued by businesses and all the rest in Scotland, because I actually think they're quite counterproductive. I don't think a lot of people necessarily believe those. But it would transform the nature of this country, wouldn't it?
It would be a very different country. We don't exactly know what's going to happen. And I think we can understand totally that people in Scotland would like more powers. And a vote for no thank you is actually going to vote for more powers. But a vote for separation, if they do vote for separation, then that's it. And it's a sort of leap in the dark. We really don't know what's going to happen.
Why on earth haven't the Better Together campaign harnessed exactly those kind of views? Because their campaign, from my perspective anyway, seems to be incredibly negative. It's all about threats. It's all about the bad things that could happen, rather than putting the positive vision for the union.
No, I think there has been a positive vision, and obviously there are some ideas that there could be a negativity that or negative things that could happen if Scotland does vote for separation. But I don't think it's all been one or the other. And I do think there's a lot of people on there who are voting for independence. They will really attack against anyone who's putting out the other point of view. And I think it's positive for democracy that the other point of view should be put out. I think a lot of pro-union people who are actually Scottish are rather worried about putting their points of view forward. They're not actually saying anything, even though they're pro-union, because they were going to get attacked so much.
I had a caller the other day who said that he'd phoned a couple of his friends in Scotland who were both intending to vote yes. And he said, but hang on a minute, you were with me on that Saturday of the Olympics when we won all those gold medals. You were cheering for the British flag. You won't get that anymore. And apparently it really made them reevaluate their reasons for voting yes, because they then realised what they'd be missing out on.
Well, the astronauts said it up in space. Then they looked down, there are no borders. We create them. Is the third millennium, the beginning of the third millennium, the time to actually set one up? Because you can get more. A vote for no thank you is a vote for more powers and staying together. And the Olympics, that'll go. What we had, that beautiful thing in the Olympics, where the country was so together. I mean, so together. I think it is a beautiful thing that Scottish people and English people, Welsh people, Northern Irish people, that we are together. We are the United Kingdom. We're a success. And to split that up is going to be tragic.
The vote clearly is on a knife edge. How confident can you be that your side will win?
You could never be confident, but as I say again, it is a beautiful thing that we're not picking up swords. People are getting angry, and we know that, you know, it's really going right up to that edge, but no one's saying, let's get any weapons out. There's no fighting. That is the beautiful thing about it. So whatever will happen. But we just want to send a message up to say Scotland is family, and we just like to say we care.
Eddie Izzard in conversation there with Ian Dale on Britain's LBC Radio. And we'll have continuing coverage of the Scottish referendum from the FSN teams in Edinburgh and in London all week here on FSN Reports. And finally tonight, on the day President Obama unveiled a much more muscular response to the Ebola crisis in West Africa, an interview with the microbiologist who first identified the disease. Peter Piot was just 27 years old when he diagnosed Ebola for the first time in the mid-1970s. He went on to become the executive director of UNAIDS, the director of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and an Undersecretary General of the United Nations. In this report, produced for the Financial Times, he talks to the newspaper's science editor Clive Cookson about his experiences.
In 1976, the young Belgian medical worker, Peter Piot, travelled to Yambuku, a remote Congolese village suffering from a devastating outbreak of a mysterious new illness. His work there helped to contain and identify the deadly Ebola hemorrhagic fever, which kills 90% of its victims. The death toll in Yambuku in 1976 was about 300. Peter went on to become one of the outstanding public health leaders of his generation, directing the global fight against HIV/AIDS for 13 years as head of UNAIDS. Earlier this year, Peter returned to the once flourishing village. I caught up with him in his director's office at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and I started by asking how Yambuku has changed since his original visit almost 40 years ago.
Today, I must say, there's kind of generalized decay. Was very sad to see. It's a very idyllic place, you know, it's beautiful. It's like a postcard nearly, but the buildings are kind of imploding, literally collapsing, some of them. They're no longer coffee plantations. There's no electricity, no running water, no shower, no fridge. But the hospital has, you know, as a dedicated physician, who I find is a hero, because you know, to work in these circumstances is fantastic. It requires a lot of courage and dedication.
Going back to Ebola, you and your colleagues managed to stop the original outbreak, yet Ebola still recurs. We have an outbreak in West Africa now, as you know. Why does this very stoppable disease keep on coming back?
We are an accidental host, in a sense. The virus is hiding somewhere, most probably some fruit-eating bat, and then we are becoming infected in an accidental way, either during, you know, hunting or preparing, you know, the meat, because bats are eaten also. And we are not a good host, because the virus kills us within 2 weeks, basically, 90% of people. And we are not a good host, because then the virus has to jump yet to another host. So we still don't know where the reservoir is. And it's also a disease of poverty, because every single outbreak up to now has happened around the hospital, where basic hygiene was not respected, where injections are given with the same needles to different patients, and so on. So it shouldn't happen. If a patient with Ebola would end up in London in a hospital, for example, I'm quite sure it would not give rise to a major epidemic.
Now, you're best known as a public health leader for your work on another disease that originated in animals, which is HIV/AIDS. And I was interested that you found signs that back in 76 there was HIV infection, although of course no one had heard of the disease then.
Yeah, it's very interesting that AIDS was described for the first time in 1981 in the United States. But then we were seeing quite some patients coming from Central Africa when I was still working in Belgium. We went there. I went with some colleagues from Zaire, from the US. We found a major heterosexual epidemic. The dogma was that this is a gay disease, which of course is absurd, you know, from the perspective of a virus, doesn't work. But then I was always very intrigued, how long has this virus been around? Where is it coming from? And one of the first clues that it had been circulating in Central Africa was because we had preserved our blood samples from 1976 during the first Ebola outbreak. We had tested thousands of people in that region. And when the antibody test became available for HIV in 85, we tested these sera, and what did we find? There was already HIV in Yambuku area 5 years before the disease was described. That was very new, but it was at very low level. And 10 years later, we went back in 86, and it was at the same level. So what we found is that in an area where there isn't amplification of HIV through multiple sex partners and so on, it can remain at very low levels.
So what is there anything we can learn from these two very different diseases, Ebola and HIV/AIDS, that have moved from animals to people, about how we might treat anything that jumps out of the animal kingdom and bites us in the future?
New viruses will continue to emerge. We're seeing it actually in the most visible way with the regular appearance of new types of influenza viruses, yes, usually coming from China. And that's also originating in animals. It's ducks or chickens and sometimes, pigs. So that's the first thing. It will continue. Even if infectious diseases, thanks to antibiotics, vaccines and so on, are on the decline, we will continue to see new infections. And secondly is that we should think of our health as the health related to the health of animals, of other animals, I should say. We call it one health. And many new infections come from animals, and we'll see more and more of that. And a third example of that is antimicrobial resistance. We are under threat of bacteria that may no longer be treatable. We already have it for tuberculosis, some forms, but also for kind of very common infections that you can acquire in a hospital.
Yes, the World Health Organization issued a warning just this week, a rather dire warning about the need to fight antibiotic resistance.
I agree, and I think that's one of the biggest threats to health for the future, because just imagine a world where bacterial infections, pneumonia or wound infections and whatever you, are no longer treatable with the current antibiotics. Surgery, for many indications, heavy surgery would not be possible. Transplants, bone marrow transplants, some cancer treatments. So they all depend on the fact that we can control infection.
So finally, Peter, to sum it all up, how would you describe the state of global public health today?
Well, I'm an optimist by nature, otherwise I wouldn't have done in my life what I've done. But I think, first of all, there's no doubt that we're leading a longer life and better lives all over. But the bad news, I would say, is that there are new epidemics looming. Diabetes, cardiovascular disease is now becoming the top cause of death also in developing countries. It's no longer a problem of the affluent in developing countries or of our type of countries. Obesity is growing. When we talk about malnutrition today in a country like India, we have on the one hand 100 million children or so that are undernourished, and then we have soon the largest number of obese people in the same country. And so it's getting more complicated.
More complicated indeed. That's Peter Piot talking to Clive Cookson of the Financial Times. And today the United Nations said $1 billion in emergency funds is now needed to combat the virus he first identified. And that's FSN Reports for this Tuesday. Tomorrow, the latest from the FSN team in Scotland ahead of Thursday's vote on independence. Let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. I'm Simon Marks from Washington. Goodbye.